Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this month's issue of Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine podcast. On this podcast, we'll be discussing the January 2020 issue of Critical Decisions. So happy New Year, everyone. Critical Decisions is ASAP's official CME publication. And if you don't know it yet, what are you waiting for? Critical Decisions is a fantastic publication. It involves two lessons that discuss the critical decisions that you would be thinking about when you're facing that situation. And it has a bunch of other fantastic things as well.
There are the critical EKG, critical image, and then, of course, my favorite, the LLSA review.
So let's get started. For our first lesson today, we have bug bites about foodborne illness. Thank you to the authors, Dr. Jonathan Glasser and Dr. Stephen Chafee.
So this was quite an interesting article. I learned that 1 in 6 people every year in the U.S. experience foodborne illnesses. And the most common pathogen that we think about are, of course, on like cruise ships, norovirus. But we definitely worry about things like salmonella, campylobacter, listeria in the ED because these are associated with more hospitalizations and deaths. In this article, we'll talk about the ones that we commonly encounter in the U.S., but certainly travel history is important because there's a whole lot of bugs that are possibly encountered when you're traveling. So check out the WHO or the CDC if you have a patient who has just recently traveled from another part of the world.
All right. So someone's coming in with a GI illness, so vomiting, diarrhea, what do we do? Other than, of course, we need to think of the non-infectious etiology, like ACS with belly pain and vomiting, ischemic gut and all that stuff. But let's just say we thought of all these things. What do we do with the vomiting and diarrhea?
Oh, protect yourself. No.
Yes.
Hopefully the patient is not vomiting onto you. But I think when we're interviewing one of these patients, we certainly think about the timing of their symptoms, maybe their associated symptoms. So classically, we always learn that if somebody starts to have their symptoms 6 to 12 hours after they ate something, then you would be worried about
Staph aureus and be serious.
Yes.
So things as preformed toxins.
Exactly. So these preformed toxins, you know, if you think about it, you ingested these toxins, so they're going to have an effect on your upper GI system more. So they're going to have more vomiting than diarrhea. Whereas if somebody develops symptoms after 24 hours, you think about actual microbial invasion or internal toxin production that causes more of the lower GI symptoms of diarrhea. So there's a great table in this article. There's many, many great tables, but table 5 actually is a great summary of common pathogen incubation periods and the duration of illness.
All right. So, I mean, we're talking about GI illness, so we have to talk about the poop, Wendy. Let's talk about the poop.
Yes. We in medicine love talking about poop, and some of our patients love talking about poop.
So, yes. Wasn't there a song on that TV show? Was it called Scrubs?
Yeah.
Where they had a song about it's all about poop.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's all about poop.
It is. It is. Yeah. So when a patient comes in with diarrhea, you might ask them, well, what does it look like? And if they describe that the diarrhea is watery, you might think more of things that are more viral, more of the preformed toxins because of that osmotic dysfunction that happens. Whereas if the patient is actually having mucoid or bloody diarrhea with tenesmus and pain, then you're going to think more about bacteria or parasites. And certainly the time frame, again, is important. If you're dealing with symptoms that are less than 2 weeks, again, more viral or bacterial. If it's more than 2 weeks, then you actually more have to worry about things like parasites or non-infectious causes. And again, food is important, especially for boards. And another table in this article, table 4, has a great summary of the common foods that you think about with specific infectious diarrheal symptoms. And remember that food can be contaminated at any stage. And so you can get sick not just from food that you eat outside of your home.
So reading this section makes me want to like not eat anything ever, because apparently you can get sick and die from everything. So vegetables, chicken, eggs, meat, fish, seafood, shellfish. So like just the
water.
So you know, I now live in Japan for a large part of the year, and this is like a nightmare when you read this because they eat everything raw. Did you know that I ate raw chicken? It's a thing. You eat chicken sashimi. So,
yuck. What about salmonella?
Apparently, well, I didn't have salmonella. And it was the same day that I also ate blowfish, so fugu. Uh-huh. And I'm right here talking to you, so I lived for both experiences. With no GI illness. But yeah, if you read this, you're probably going to think that you're going to die from all of the food. That's you will true. Not die from all of the food.
Yeah. And again, that's a very good example that preparation is key, right? You probably trust raw seafood or chicken in the Japanese restaurant rather than on the streets or something like that. All right. Well, another thing you have to think about is that could this patient actually be having an allergic reaction or anaphylaxis? But those symptoms are typically faster in onset right after the exposure. And don't forget about toxidromes, another board favorite. Things like toxic mushrooms can cause cholinergic symptoms, or botulism causing anticholinergic symptoms.
All right. So we talked about the GI illness stuff. So we talked about the vomiting, the diarrhea, like definitely belly pain and stuff comes with that. But what else other than GI symptoms should we be thinking about?
Sure. Certainly there might be systemic symptoms, whether the patient might be febrile. And then you also have to think of what could they be having signs that they're dehydrated. And then I think more importantly, you have to also figure out if they have any neurological symptoms, because some of these...
My gosh, Wendy,
yes.
Even in the GI foodborne one, you found something to talk about.
Yeah, the brain-gut, connection, it's strong. So some of these pathogens that you will read about in the article can cause neurological conditions like Guillain-Barré, encephalitis, or again, classic board question, Shiga toxin causing seizures. So check out table 3.
I mean, vomiting and diarrhea are things that happen to everyone. Who should we worry about? Because we can't worry about all of the vomiting and diarrhea. That's way too much worrying. Apparently, we would be worrying about 1 out of every 6 people in this country.
That is true. More commonly when they come to the ED. Yeah. So I think you have to worry about the classic people who are more at risk for more severe illness. So the extremes of age, whether they're really young or really old, the immunosuppressed patients, the pregnant patients.
Anything special about the exam in a patient with vomiting and diarrhea?
I think we alluded to the fact that these patients could be very dehydrated or hypovolemic. And then specifically on your abdominal exam, if you have severe tenderness or peritoneal signs, you have to be worried about invasive disease or complications like obstructions or perforations. And actually, don't forget the rectal exam to evaluate for any sort of bleeding. And again, the neurological exam.
Oh,
yes.
So who do we need to test?
That's a good question, because I think this comes up a lot, especially with our trainees. Normally, you don't have to get many tests. You might have to think about getting stool cultures for very ill patients or patients who have very severe symptoms, profuse watery diarrhea, severe pain, symptoms greater than 1 week. Those who are getting admitted, partly also to help you figure out, of course, about infectious risks in spread of this disease. You're specifically worried about Campylobacter, Shigella, enterohemorrhagic E. coli, etc., or C. diff that we commonly think about in the hospital setting. You might want to consider sending those tests. In terms of if you're specifically taking care of, let's say, a food handler, that would be a really good idea to send off some tests, even if they're well appearing, just again, for public health reasons.
Got it. So here's a question. With urine, or when we're worried that someone has a urine infection, then we send the UA for whites. And then if there are whites, then we say, okay, well, this is infectious and we need to, make a big deal about it. And then we send it for cultures and all that. Why don't we do the same thing with poop?
You can. You can actually evaluate for certain
You can do a lot of things. Would it be smart to do that is the question.
Maybe the lab doesn't like this, to look at poop under the microscope. But more so that fecal leukocytes are not actually very well correlated with a positive culture. So I don't think it's very helpful. But apparently, if you were to send for fecal lactoferrin, it's actually been shown to be 93% positively associated with Campylobacter and Salmonella. But this can actually be positive in IBS and IBD too. So that's interesting.
So inflammation as well, obviously.
Right.
Can be a lot more often.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I think really the main test that we think about when we're dealing with patients like this is whether or not they might need, labs to look at their renal function because they're really hypovolemic, or abdominal imaging. And then if you're worried about listeria, you need to make sure, of course, your female patients are not pregnant. And don't forget, if you do get some positive tests showing that this patient has a significant infection, such as salmonella, listeria, vibrio, etc., you have to notify the CDC.
Got it. So for treatment, what do you do?
Yeah, mostly supportive, symptomatic. So a lot of rehydration, whether it's oral, you can use broth or fruit juices or the actual WHO rehydration solution. And then I think you can also consider anti-motility agents like loperamide. Of course, we wouldn't use loperamide specifically in bloody diarrhea because we're worried about, you know, bacterial invasive diarrhea. If you're worried about C. diff, if you have proven shigatoxin E. coli infection or shigella.
So what I personally do is that I ask people to, instead of like buying the commercial rehydration solution, to water down Gatorade to half and half or alternate. So like a bottle of Gatorade and a bottle of water. I just find that that's a little easier maybe to access than other more commercial or more expensive items. So how about antibiotics? Who do we give antibiotics to?
We really only give antibiotics to patients who are at risk for a bad outcome. So again, you're kind of the extremes of age, immunocompromised patients, because we're really trying to balance, you know, the overuse of antibiotics that can lead to antibiotic resistance, but it actually also can increase the risk of hemolytic uremic syndrome. As for traveler's diarrhea, and typically we think about these as symptoms that are less than 1 week when you're traveling from a developed to less developed country with non-severe symptoms and really nothing else that is concerning. Sometimes the question comes up on antibiotic prophylaxis or treatment. You can certainly consider that with fluoroquinolones for 3 days or azithromycin for just a single dose.
Got it. Because I get asked this question all the time when people are like, hey, I'm traveling. Can you write me a script so that if I get diarrhea, I can take it? And I'm like, wait, what? So apparently it's a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So a patient comes in with a GI illness. How do we manage their disposition?
Well, I think most of these patients, after you give them supportive care, treat their nausea, vomiting, rehydrate them, they're going to be safe for discharge. But specifically, if you're taking care of a food handler or healthcare workers, they should really avoid going back to work until 48 hours after resolution of all of their symptoms. So that certainly could be quite a period of time.
I was going to say, that sounds like a long time.
Yeah, exactly. And people have to follow that. Because again, it's for the health of everybody else around them. And a lot of education about hygiene, education about food handling, etc. And there's so much information in this article about that. So check it out for ourselves and for our patients.
That was very informative. I did not know that you're not supposed to allow food to cool before refrigerating. I used to think that you're not supposed to put hot food and then just like close the Pyrex or whatever it is and then just put it in the fridge because, I don't know, it looks explode. I don't know what happens. So I thought that you're not supposed to do that.
Right.
But apparently, according to this, you are supposed to put it in the refrigerator while it's hot. And then something else that I was actually taught before, and then I learned that it's not correct, is that a lot of people think you should wash chicken and meat before you cook it
it.
And apparently that's bad because you're going to spread infection into the water source.
Oh.
Yeah.
Whoa.
So this article tells you you're not supposed to wash meat or chicken.
These are hard habits to break. But again, for the goodness of our GI system.
So yeah, so there's a lot of very informative stuff, not just for your GI patient, but for you to not become one. Thank you, Wendy, for taking us through this article. It was really great. You reminded us of the importance of taking a good history to try to figure out like the timing, what they ate, and not just say, oh, have you eaten anything from outside? And then there were fantastic tip-offs for specific causes and the fact that we should think of non-infectious etiology. And then, of course, we need to take high-risk patients seriously. So less than a year, over 65, pregnant, immunosuppressed.
Okay, so what's next?
So for our critical procedure this month, we have a mucosal drainage and removal.
Okay, I've never heard of this. Have you?
Nope. And I definitely have not ever done it, but it sounds pretty simple. So basically, we're talking about the mucosal, which is like the one that on the inside of your mouth. And the whole idea is that you just numb it and de-roof it. And the most important thing to remember is that before you poke at it with something sharp, please make sure it's not like an aneurysm. And if it looks cancerous, you probably don't want to be mucking around that and you want them to go see someone who can biopsy it and follow it up.
Good point. take a picture at what a mucus seal looks like. For our critical EKG this month,
Yeah, my diagnosis for this EKG is that it's really, really ugly. That's all I got for you.
I agree. For our readers and listeners, it's a wide complex tachycardia with a rate of 115. And so certainly you might have to think about things like hyperkalemia or sodium channel blocker toxicity. So definitely read through this. It's a good one.
All right. So let's talk about our critical cases in orthopedics and trauma.
Yeah. The Montasia fracture. Aren't there some mnemonics to help us remember this?
Yep. So the ones I remember is GRUM or MUGGER. So MUGGER is Montasia ulnar is broken with the radial head dislocation. And then the Galeazzi is a broken radius. So that's the mnemonic. And the reason it's important is because if it's displaced, like the fracture is displaced, these patients need to go to the OR to have an open reduction internal fixation, not a conservative treatment. And it's important because if you're reading your own x-rays, you need to make sure you're not missing that radial head dislocation. So definitely take a look at this article. There's a bunch of great images. It also talks about the classification of this fracture. So definitely something worth a review, especially if you look at your own x-rays at night.
All right. For our LLSA review this month, I think you gave it to me because I like the LLSA review, but also it's hard to pronounce. Let me give this a try.
Okay. See, you don't just get to talk about neurology. You get the tough names.
All right. Idarucizumab. Wait. It sounded much better in my head. But
you know what? Just
we're gonna go brand name. Sorry guys.
Go brand name.
Praxbind. Much easier to say. So we're talking about the Bigatran or Pradaxa reversal and this particular relatively new medication. So remember that the Bigatran is a direct thrombin inhibitor. And before this medication, we used to give FFP or factor 7, do dialysis and supportive care to reverse this in life-threatening bleeds. But this particular medication, Praxbind, or this long generic name.
Idarucizumab.
Yes, exactly. That was good.
Just dang it.
Yeah, I got to say it fast. Like I can type it out or spell it, but I can't say it. So approved in 2015, it's a monoclonal antibody that binds to the thrombin binding site on the dabigatran. So it's great in that it doesn't overcorrect. It has a short half-life that allows you to restart your medication if needed within 24 hours. But it is very expensive. And I don't think the clinically relevant outcomes like hemostasis and mortality are very clear yet.
Well, that's a great reminder. And you got to enjoy your LSA review. Now, we get to talk about small dilemmas or pediatric ethical issues. So thank you to the authors, Dr. Desiree Michelle Siavi, Dr. Evan Sherman, and Dr. Caleb Ward.
What a double whammy. I mean, pediatrics is complex enough, and then when you throw in some ethical and legal issues, I'm glad that there are some great cases that kind of helps us think through these concepts, whether it's about informed consent or about the basic ethical principles. But I think the one that comes up all the time in the ED is competency.
So competence is what the courts decide. That is not our job. What we need to figure out is decision-making capacity, just like we do with adults. And with decision-making capacity, it's decision-specific and situation-specific. And just like with adults, we need to look at that person or that child's guardian or parent and make sure that they have the capacity to understand the situation, communicate about it, and evaluate the alternatives. And it's definitely important to remember that just because they disagree with a medical opinion does not mean that they don't have capacity, because people can have different goals of care. And that is definitely a challenging situation.
Very good reminders. So what do you do if the physician and the parent don't agree?
Well, with adult patients, you're like, okay, you're an adult, you understand what you're doing to yourself. You can just not do what you need to have done if you have capacity. But in this case, you're expecting the parent or guardian to act within the child's best interest. And now they're refusing what you think is the child's best interest. So the first question you got to ask yourself is, does the decision they're making harm the child? Will the child have loss of life, loss of health, or deprivation of basic needs? If the answer is no, they are not causing the child harm, then done. They get to do what they want to do. Now, if there is harm, then you need to try to explain to the parent or guardian and you need to reach a compromise. If they are causing that child harm and there's no compromise that can be reached, especially if they're imminently trying to take the child away from medical care, then you need to involve law enforcement. And if you have to do something immediately, then you need to proceed with it. So, for example, let's say someone is hypotensive or they're going to lose a limb or CPR needs to commence, whatever it is. As long as you don't believe that this is an intentional decision to harm the child, then you need to proceed irrelevant of the present of that consent.
I see.
Or let's say you can't even reach the parent.
Right,
then
exactly.
Just go ahead and do what you need to do if it is immediate care. And the article does have a table in there that explains in detail, like, several situations.
All right. So what about research?
So that is really tricky. Because on one hand, interventions that we do because of research can cause harm. That's the whole reason we're doing research, is to make sure that they don't before the general public can use it. But if we don't test it on children, then we're going to end up with treatment standards that have never been tested on children. And now we're trying to use it on them in clinical practice. So it's kind of worse. And that's actually what happened with chloramphenicol in the 1950s, where they were like, oh, it's safe for adults, use it on children. And they're like, oh, yeah, we can't. That was not smart. So with research, just like clinical care, you have to get informed consent from the parent or guardian. And now if the risk is a little higher, some IRBs are going to require the consent of both parents, if both parents are alive and present. Wards of the state are incredibly tricky because they're an even more vulnerable population than regular children. Something else to keep in mind with research, and I actually think that's also something that you may want to incorporate in clinical care as well, is that children over the age of 7, they're going to be asked to assent, which is that you give them the power to veto something after you explain it to them in a child-friendly way. That way, you're trying to preserve as much of the autonomy that they can preserve as a child.
I like that. And I think, yeah, that's definitely applicable, the concept of assent, in any person who may not have the decision-making capacity, but is part of your care. All right. Surely in the emergency department, if we're talking about emergency research, there must be some caveats.
Absolutely. So the same as adults, right? Emergency research is allowed because there are some things that you're going to have to do emergency research on. So according to the DHHS final rule, the consent is waived if the condition is life-threatening, it's not feasible for you to get that informed consent, there's an apparent benefit to the participant, and there's a defined therapeutic window. So I think the best example is status epilepticus. And then another alternative is that you may choose to defer the consent rather than waiving it. So for example, you treat the patient with something that's within the standard of care, but you're trying to figure out, like, which treatment within the standard of care is better, and then ask for the consent so that you can follow them up and see what happened. So, for example, somebody comes in with a seizure, they can get either lorazepam or diazepam, which are both acceptable treatments. You don't get the consent at that moment, but get the consent after that seizure has been treated and their symptoms are under control.
Okay. What about advanced directives? I never thought about this in children.
So, fortunately, we don't see a lot of children with life-limiting illnesses in our line of practice. However, the number of children that are living with life-limiting illnesses is increasing because science is getting better. They're not dying in infancy. They're able to live with these life-limiting illnesses. And advanced directives can either include something called DNEs, which is do not escalate, and then DNRs, which we think of. And then obviously, like, they can talk about whatever else that they want to direct their care. And in 1991, although there was a huge push to actively solicit them from adult patients, that push was not present for the pediatric population. And this statistic really shocked me. It is estimated that less than 3% of the parents of children with a life-limiting illness have an advanced directive, which means that there is 97% of these children whom we cannot care for the way they and their parents want to be cared for. Something to remember is that the legal guardian has the choice to verbally revoke an advanced directive at any time. And then, of course, that a DNR form must be verified with an actual document or a bracelet. And if child shows up, CPR is started, and then that correct, valid document is presented after CPR is started, then CPR must be stopped.
Wow. Okay. So tell me a little bit more about this do not escalate, because I think we
may talk about it in adult patients, but I never have heard of it framed as an actual thing that people sign up for.
So the concept of do not escalate is that sometimes people feel uncomfortable stopping a current treatment. However, they would say they don't want a new one. So do not escalate the current mode of treatment. So if whatever they're on right now, so for example, let's say they're on a CPAP, and if the CPAP doesn't work, then they do not want to escalate it to intubation. However, they're not comfortable having that CPAP taken off or removed. So that's the concept of do not escalate. And it's something that the parents or legal guardians of children may choose to have.
Gotcha. Article also mentions the concept of a, quote, slow code.
So this is my first time hearing it mentioned in this way, but I've heard of people doing that. So the concept of a slow code is doing inadequate or half-hearted CPR. And some people also call it a show code. So when you pretend to code a patient, but you're not really doing a good job because you know that the resus efforts are unlikely to be effective and the patient is not DNR, although in your personal opinion, they should be. And this is unethical. It's deceptive. It is wrong. Don't do it. Just don't. If you honestly don't think that this person should have CPR performed, then while CPR is being performed, you need to talk to the parents. Or if you see that this is the situation where it's going, then have this conversation sooner rather than later. Just pretending to do CPR on someone just to make it look like you did something is a horrible idea. Please don't.
Yeah, I agree. Bad for certainly the patient and their family, but also bad for your team and your staff, for sure. Well, thank you, Dania, for taking us through this article. It was a great reminder, not only for, I think, pediatric patients, but also adult patients in the ED. I think it's always important to remember that what we do when we're dealing with a patient's decision-making capacity in the ED is trying to decide it specific to the decision that you're trying to elicit, as well as the situation that this is in. And this means you have to demonstrate that the patient understands the situation, is able to understand the alternatives.
And the biggest thing is that parents and caregivers can disagree with you, and it is okay as long as it's not causing harm to the child.
Right, exactly. And I learned a lot about the fact that certainly pediatric patients can have advanced directives, including things like do not escalate, although the numbers of patients with these are rare. But like you also mentioned, with the number of children with life-limiting illnesses on the rise, these are potentially things that we'll have to address more and more in the ED.
Absolutely. So moving on to less sad situations, let's talk about the critical image, which is also about a child.
Yes, and kind of sad.
It is sad that it is, you know, 2020 and we are still seeing this. So it's an interesting image for something that we don't see often. And it was actually incidentally found on a bony x-ray of a child. And I'm going to give you a hint. You find it in purely breastfed infants. And what you see on the bones is cupping and fraying. So can you guess what it is, Wendy?
Whoa. Well, it is rare now. And it is an important diagnosis to catch. So thank goodness this team caught it. But it's rickets, because breastfed children don't have the vitamin D that formula-fed children have supplemented, unless they're exposed to lots of UV sunlight to be able to make their own vitamin D. Ooh, wow.
Yep. So on to our drug box for this month, we have ophthalmic diclofenac. And it's basically an NSAID for your eye. And a lot of people use it peri-op, so after like cataract surgery, whatever it is. But some way we can use it in the emergency department is also with corneal abrasions. You have a max of 2 weeks where you can use it. And the one thing that you need to know is that there are some evidence out there that it may slow healing. So know your local ophthalmologist's opinion before you start all of your patients on ophthalmic diclofenac. Again, it's not clear data.
Okay. Oh, it's a great drug to have up your sleeve. And our tax box this month is on lamotrigine overdose, as we commonly see it for patients who have bipolar disorders or seizure disorders. Remember that it's a sodium channel blocker and it inhibits serotonin reuptake. So in the overdose situation, it can cause sedation, seizures, ventricular dysrhythmias, and serotonin syndrome. And if you needed to treat any of these, you would use benzos for seizures, bicarb for the YQRS on EKG, and hemodialysis if needed.
Well, that was a great reminder of something that we see more often than we should.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Wendy, for going through this issue with me. Dear listeners, I hope this was as fun for you to listen to as it was for us to record. With you was Dani Koja.
And Wendy Chang.
And please reach out to us on Twitter and let us know what you think. Share with us your cases, and we look forward to talking to you next month. Our Twitter handles are at Danya Koja,
at EM_NCC.
And until next month,
bye-bye.